Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode number 121. It's brought to you by two lovely sponsors, Environments for Humans, who are promoting their CSS Summit, which is an online conference. Go to the URL cssummit.com and it'll redirect you where you need to go. That's coming up July 15th through 17th. Use coupon code Shop Talk Show for 20% off. And Campaign Monitor is an email sending service who, you know, this just came out like yesterday or today or something. They named their new builder inside Campaign Monitor Canvas, and it's really cool to check out. Go to campaignmonitor.com. We'll tell you more about all that stuff later on the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Here comes the drop.
Sick drop.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a front-end podcast all about web design development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. I know it feels like just another Shop Talk Show to you, but you know that there's been a whole bunch of rapid-fire shows in a row. That's weird just because of travel and summer, and we've been doing stuff. So in the behind the scenes, we haven't actually recorded one in a little while, so it feels good to be back in the saddle talking and stuff. We have Sam. Oh, crap. I forgot to ask you. Is it just Capilla? Did I do it right?
Capilla.
We have Sam. Welcome to the show, Sam. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yay! Otherwise known as Sam Cap, that's the whole reason I don't know how to say your whole last name is because everybody abbreviates it.
Yeah, anytime Dave introduces me to anyone, it's like, have you met Sam Cap?
With no space.
It's one word. Yep. It's absolutely one word.
Mm-hmm. Your Twitter handle and stuff, and it just rolls off the tongue nicely. What's that, Dave?
Oh, I mean, I could go the whole, this is Samira Capilla, that whole route, but it's Sam Cap. That's it. It's that easy.
Mm-hmm.
Like a brand.
Yeah, when my parents don't call me what they used to call me anymore, and they just call me Sam Cap, you know it's going to stick.
Whoa.
Whoa.
Mm. I should get my parents on the CC. No, it's not working. Sam's from Austin, Texas with Dave, so it's kind of an Austin special.
Woohoo!
Yeah. And Sam is, I'm just going to do a little intro stuff so people know who we're talking to, what's everything's about. Also, you know, is no stranger to podcasts and is a co-host on the Non-Breaking Space podcast, which is kind of which features Christopher Schmidt sometimes or whatever, and who's from Environments for Humans too. So there's some synergy there. And the ATX web show and is from the land of the hipster sea. Tell us about that.
Hipster C is a term that Chris Schmidt coined for the French C that's in the title of Curacao, the name of the island.
It has a title tag of Curacao.
It's in the database. Yeah.
Sorry, brain fried. So it's just the second C is a French C, the Cedilla, or I like to call it the Cedilla. As if I was on Napoleon Dynamite. And yeah, it's just the French C, but Chris Schmidt calls it the hipster C, which I kind of like that a lot.
Yeah, it's got the little dingus thing on the bottom of it. It looks cool. It is hip.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like how you, on your very lovely website, have like a big version of it over the island, and it's awesome looking.
Yeah, I thought I'd throw that on there.
Yeah, it looks good. It looks like, you know, I don't know what I'm saying. It's just lovely. You're a teacher at Texas State University, right? Is that the one with the Longhorns or what?
That is not. That is the one with the Bobcats. Lyndon B. Johnson went there and George Strait went there.
Whoa.
I didn't teach either of them, though.
I didn't know that. That's some Texas trivia. Mm-hmm. That's really nice.
George Strait, the American country singer, or George, some guy who's not gay?
The first one.
The country singer. We should say, so Sam, like, no, like, don't be humble here. Texas State has a really great like education program around the web. Like specifically, you're like there teaching responsive web design to students in real time as like tweets and things are happening. You have to like adjust your curriculum. Is that like, can you kind of walk us through like how you're teaching responsive web design to a college?
Yeah, it started about 3 years ago when we were looking to change out what the Flash class had in its curriculum. So it was the same week that Ethan's book came out, and I'd like just cracked open the book, but hadn't really gotten into it. I'd read the List Apart article, and then we decided that it should be a class. And with a lot of help from other faculty that teach in the web area, and this is in a traditional design print program that has a web component. So with the other web faculty, kind of worked on making that a bigger class. We had about 18 students in the fall of 2011, I think it was. And Dave, that was, I think, even the semester that you came down and spoke with the Parabell guys. And having folks like you guys around and a lot of support from the Austin community, was able to start teaching that. And
you
Twitter
started teaching responsive web design like super early. It might have been the first course ever on it. If it came out, if you did this like right at the time the book came out, that's kind of amazing.
It struck you as
this is what we need to teach.
Yeah. You know, Flash is not exactly, I don't think Flash is dead. I don't think anything really dies ever, but it just wasn't the best tool at the time. And not that responsive web design is a tool, but it is something that, well, I mean, what I really like about it is that it covers everything web related. It has a lot of the strategic stuff that you need to think about. That is my favorite part of design. The critical thinking, solving problems, how do you make this work for different scenarios, for different people. It has web typography stuff, which I obsess over. So it's basically everything I love in life.
I like that idea that it makes for a good teaching tool because it's like a little bit extra complicated. I mean, of course there's problem solving in design anyway, right? There's like, how do we solve these communication problems? And there's just the normal amount of problem solving and that, like, this is new to me as a student. This HTML and CSS looks foreign and complicated and you have to get through that. But then like taking design to that whole other level of, I don't know. Right. You have to adapt things for different screens. Do you find that the students that you teach like kind of inherently get it? They're like, of course websites need to look good on my phone because why wouldn't they? And that would be weird if they didn't. Do they skew young enough where they have that kind of opinion?
I think they're just so, so the responsive class right now is the second web class that they can take and they have to take it in a certain order. So they get just kind of fixed with HTML and CSS in the first class. And when they get to the second class, there's this sudden, oh my God, this makes complete sense. Why isn't all web design like this? Where has this been all my life? And then they also go through this phase of they resize every single page they pull up and then hate anything that isn't responsive. So then but that opens up the opportunity to have a conversation about, well, it's a process. It's an option. It's not always the best option. And then they say, why not? It seems so great. And then you can bring up things like the differences between native apps and web apps and different things that, you know, so it's a good conversation.
So you have to go through a little stage where you're kind of a jerk about it and then you kind of mature into.
Yeah, I think that happens with everything, though. Like, at first, I mean, I think about it with Papyrus and Comic Sans, where it was like, yeah, I'm going to use these fonts, and then you learn in school that you don't have to use them, and then you're like, oh, I can't believe, like, anybody would ever use them. And I feel like so many things go through that phase of, like, oh, yeah, I can't believe, like, this site isn't responsive. And it's like, well, you know, your first couple sites weren't responsive, and that's okay. And, like, oh, God. I don't know, it's just fun.
Yeah,
I like to think I'm in my post-Papyrus phase, you know.
I hope so. I hope so.
Whatever.
Yeah.
I used to use that.
I still have undergrad projects that have Papyrus on it, and I think it's good to reflect and look back. Yeah. But that's it.
I like that. Well, I like
it's nice. It's like an ancient Egyptian wrote it. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh my god. Or Greek, or anything Asian, or. Oh man, I could. I really do want a list of things that people think papyrus is okay for. And it's just
.com.
I like that font family fantasy is what maps to papyrus. That's its first choice. I love that. Let's see. So we have some questions to get to. That's the meat and potatoes of the Shop Talk show. Of course, I feel like Dave, you were going to mention A to Z CSS. We had some.
Yes. So we had a guy, and I'm going to murder last name, Rutledge, I believe, wrote in to share. You know how we occasionally were like, hey, if you're working on something super cool, like you had a fun project to like learn more about websites, share that with us. But so he created A to Z CSS.com. And check this out. He went through like all these properties and made like whatever 26 videos of alphabetical, like learning, like how everything works, like float, sibling selectors, hover, ID, justify. Like he's walking all the way through, everything. Yeah,
it's an ABC book essentially, you know, like A is for art. B is for butt, you know, but it's like CSS words instead. And it's really cool. And I'm super jealous of it because I still have on my computer a document where I was going to, this is like my dream was to write, the ABCs of CSS book, which is essentially this exact thing, only like illustrated and stuff. And I was working with illustrators and we were going to make it like a story and it was going to be really cool. And then it just, I totally failed and dropped the ball on it. But I'm glad that somebody else picked it up and actually got it done. And that's why we're mentioning it. Good work. Check out A to Z CSS.
You could still do it. You could still do it, Chris. But
oh, I know.
This is very cool, though. He's done a really great job. So thanks for sharing. This might work for you, Sam, in the classroom.
Oh, yeah. So. This is amazing. I am freaking out over. I'm already at S right now. This is great. I've learned so much just from this right now.
Oh, are they little? They're videos? Oh, they are.
Yeah, he does like whatever, 5-minute videos for each letter.
Oh, that's come on, time son. Too. God, if only podcasts would stop being an hour long. God, if anybody has that kind of attention span these days. Jeez.
I know. What's
okay, there's another thing I want to mention, but we'll get to that when we do a sponsor a little later. Let's do a few questions first because those are just so fun. And we have Sam with us who's a teacher and designer and knows all kinds of stuff. We kind of went a little heavy with the educational based questions just to theme the show a little bit. Let's do one here from Noah Bass.
It's a little bit of a deep dive here. So Noah Bass calls in. Audio question, folks. Remember how...
Ooh.
Like, this is a podcast with audio. Calls in with an audio question. Here we go.
Hey, Dave and Chris. Love the show. I have a question about school and university stuff. I am currently a sophomore in high school, and I'm just about to go into my junior year. I would imagine that you guys went to college and studied something IT and tech-related. So my question is... what did you study in college? Would you change your mind if you could go back? What kinds of studies do you recommend or do not recommend? And can you share any experiences? So far, I have thought about software engineering or computer science. I love web development and really want to stay on that path. But I'm really not sure. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great podcast.
Thanks for your question, Noah. Did we get all that? It's kind of just like a generic life advice kind of question. And I thought, Sam, is, you know, you probably advise kids in that stuff all the time, right?
Yeah. Especially in the last couple of months, I feel that question or a similar version of that question has come up a lot of, should I go to school? Should I not go to school? Should I just learn the stuff on my own? And it's a hard thing for me to answer because in my own experience, I've done... the whole traditional undergrad and grad thing. I work at a university, but I've also seen the sides of how hard it is to get current topics in web design or in web development to actually happen in a traditional university environment.
meaning like we want to teach this stuff, but we can't because we have such an established curriculum otherwise, or the teachers don't care, or there's what are the challenges?
Some of the challenges that come up are more red tapey.
Yeah.
Especially if it's a state school, it can take 3 to 5 years to change curriculum because it needs to go from...
Wow.
Yeah, from the department themselves up to the college level where the dean is, up to the provost and university administration level, to then the state education folks.
That's wild. You think that this is not, I mean, tech, we all, you know, like that's the soundbite is how fast tech changes these days.
Yeah.
But you think it's a problem in everything you'd think. I think science mm-hmm. would be equally annoying.
Oh, yeah.
By this slope.
Absolutely. So I think there's a lot of issues that way. Now, there's definitely loopholes. Like with this responsive class, it happened to come in at a time where they were redoing a lot of stuff. So it came down to course descriptions that are in a course catalog. And we were able to just change the course description to match what we wanted to say. But rather than being so specific and saying that this is a responsive web design course, we said this is the second in multiple web design classes that cover advanced topics.
Nice. So it's vague and you can change it on your own.
Yeah, because then you're still you're still teaching what you're supposed to. But you can kind of vary within the topic a little bit. So hopefully more schools will start doing that. That's kind of worked out well for us and allowed a little bit more flexibility in how much responsive stuff we bring in, how much web typography stuff we bring in and all of that. Mm-hmm. But that's still something that, you know, unless the opportunity arises, it's really hard to really bring in. At the same time, there are a lot of groups or websites or code schools that are able to supplement university stuff or in some cases even replace it, and they don't have to worry about the red tape stuff.
That's interesting. I've never seen it marketed that way, but I wonder if they should give that a shot. Somebody like Treehouse being like, this is, you know, you can learn a lot here, but you can also think of this as supplementary to what you're learning elsewhere. I mean, why not? It's priced that way. They might as well market it that way.
Yeah, with stuff like Lynda and Treehouse, I look at them as supplementary sites, but then if you look at code schools, they could practically replace a four-year program and then save people money and time. And I think either code schools or universities, the benefit of both of them is that you have somebody there to oversee what you're working on, so that you can clean up any bad habits, you can learn from other people's mistakes, you can learn better practices, which is sometimes harder to pick up if you're self-taught.
Absolutely. So to Noah's question a little bit, there's you could go to Texas State University, in which they're already teaching pretty good stuff, but it sounds like you probably don't have your, you know, or whatever. There's reasons for you to have picked wherever you're going to go. It sounds like you have two choices, software engineering or computer science. It's interesting that you even have two at the school I went to. It's like you're this or nothing. Which one do you think is more aligned to Noah's idea? I don't know if you can answer this or not, but the two choices were software engineering and computer science. Should he pick one of those or do something else? Or how can he stay more involved with web stuff? And what can he expect?
Unfortunately, from what I've researched about computer science programs, no two are alike. So what one program would consider computer science is not what another program would consider computer science. Some focus on few languages, some that are a little bit older, like some of the C stuff, while there are computer science programs that are, you know, building out full apps and stuff like that. So it really comes down to looking at the course descriptions for any of the programs you're into and seeing if they cover what topics you're actually interested in.
It sounds like maybe software engineering is a better choice if you're mm-hmm. into web stuff, possibly.
Yeah, yeah.
Long time ago, 1998, I went into college as a computer science major, and I got to learn really useful languages like Pascal, mm-hmm. Haskell, before Haskell was cool.
I liked Pascal.
Scheme, I think, which is like a Lisp interpreter. I think now they like start you in Java, which is actually kind of useful, possibly. But what's important is kind of like, I kind of what Sam's saying, like everything's different. So you should probably like maybe call and like try to get a department, whatever advisor or something, call the department like, and just say, hey, can you give me a high level of what languages you teach, you know, like throughout a 4-year course or something like that? Cause that would probably help me. That would have helped me like pick which one I would have done. Cause I ended up switching to major in Japanese of all things. So that's obviously kind of a
so there's two points there, right? But there's kind of like the classic thing you could say that it doesn't really, you know, whatever, you're so early in your development into this stuff that it doesn't really matter. Like you're going to go and you're going to learn some you're going to learn some concepts and that will be useful to you no matter what. I feel like that's obligatory to say that kind of thing. And look at Dave. Don't we all look up to him as an incredible developer? Majored in Japanese. What up?
There you go. You don't even need the degree to have a fart sound podcast. Yeah. You literally don't need a degree to do that. Yeah, so that's what I would say. I would call and figure it out. Like I know the UT, and I think they still do, University of Texas, they kind of sway more towards the like what is it? AI kind of artificial intelligence route, which is kind of like Lisp and those kind of super recursive-y languages and stuff, just because they have a more vest that department and what they're trying to achieve has a more vested interest in like making robots think for themselves and stuff like that.
Pretty
so
fascinating.
And then you know like EE is another one, electronic engineering, I guess, which may be this software engineering thing. That's something to think about.
I always thought about that. That was pretty wild. Like, what if your dream is to work on chips?
Oh, geez.
That's just a different type of engineering, right? Maybe that is electrical.
Yeah, that would be more like EE, like electric engineering. So that's like electrical engineering. That's it. That would be more EE. That's more like you're doing circuits and pathways and stuff like that. But you do learn a lot of programming doing that. What's weird is, and this is just one college, the University of Texas, all the stuff where you learn web stuff is all through the business school because they have like a startup college or something like that, you know? So that's something to think about too. Like, I mean, maybe you're actually in the business school, which is so weird, but that's why I'd call departments and just be like, hey, high overview of what I'm learning here. You know, I think it'd be worth a day, right?
Yeah. And I think one more thing to add to that might be to actually ask them kind of what their school of thought is on just the general learning process. Because with something like even Japanese, if you learn how to learn a language rather than just focusing on I'm only going to learn this one language, it's really easy to get into other areas because you've learned how to learn, which sounds like a really weird thing to say.
Sure. I love that soundbite too, because it's so appropriate and it's so true. And then, but also at the same time, it's like it makes kids roll their eyes too, which makes me like it even more.
Yeah.
But that's probably what the difference between college and like a hack school or code school is, right? Is like code school or hack school, you're like learning one specific trade, you know, it's almost like a trade school. And but like college, you're just whatever, groove dogging for 4 years, just whatever. You don't change your sweatpants. And that's kind of how groove dogging for 4 to 6 years, you know, learning how to learn. So.
Nice.
All right, we're going to have more learning stuff to talk about here. So let's do one from Evan Huntley, who says, I am not in a position at work where it's practical or needed for me to get into things like Yeoman or Bower, even though I like to stay at the forefront of web trends. Am I becoming a dinosaur? This is a lot of these questions are emblematic of lots of different questions that we get from ShopDoc. Lots of people are like, I'm thinking about changing careers, or I'm thinking about trying to learn more about this stuff, or I'm overwhelmed with there's so much stuff to learn. Where do I start? We're going to do a number of them. This is a classic one, which is like, I see these things. I see people being excited about them. I don't have the opportunity to use them really, even though I have a job and work every day. How do you, and then the fact that you don't learn it feels like you're getting behind, and Evan's so worried about it that he thinks he's like almost, you know, becoming a dinosaur, becoming irrelevant in the industry. Is that the case?
Be honest, I had no idea what either Yeoman or Gulp or Grunt or Bower, any of those were, until I saw Dave speak a month ago, and I took notes furiously. This was at Artifact Conf, and only recently in the last couple of weeks had a chance to really look into them, and they're great tools, and they take a little while to get used to if it's not a part of your regular workflow, but it's just another tool. Doesn't mean you have to use it all the time. Necessarily. I mean, maybe I'm not at the point where I am using it all the time anyway, but I think it's important to know that it's there when you need it.
I like that. Yeah, that like you don't have to necessarily dig into it or try it, but just like learn enough about it so that your brain reaches for it should you come into needing something like that.
Yeah, and there's actually a good blog post that I will find and put in the chat room right now and send to you guys that Katie from Happy Cog, Austin, wrote about Dave's talk, like the designer's intro to these tools, that she kind of just was like, hey, this is what Dave mentioned. This is kind of what you can do with them in super designing terms. And that really helped me a lot, too, because it's A, all in one place, and B, you can see the benefit of why it's helpful to use. So.
That's great advice. Evan, I want to make you try to make you feel better a little bit in that I'm the same way with a lot of that stuff. I get Bower. I haven't used extensively on a real project, although I played with a little bit, and it's in CodeKit 2, so that's kind of a fun place to play with it. But it's just a way to download components. I don't think that it's like so tremendously industry changing that you should feel weird about not knowing what it is. It helps download stuff for you, you know, whatever. and Yeoman is more of a scaffolding thing. Again, I've literally never even used that once. I have never filed up the command tool and did it. I just don't think that people should feel tremendously guilty when they don't try everything in the world, especially if you have a job, you're working on stuff every day and getting the job done and making the site that you work on better. You know, like that's what you're doing. You're doing as much as anybody else is doing. You're learning from that experience. It certainly doesn't hurt to like, you know, read around a little bit, go to conferences and stuff and keep up to date. But I feel like we need to stop feeling bad about not being cutting edge when you are, you know, you're cutting edge and the work that you're doing on your website. Gosh darn it. Let's stop feeling bad about ourselves.
Here's a fact. Dinosaurs are rad. So quit worrying about that.
Yeah. I wish it would turn into a dinosaur. That would be amazing.
Yeah. And then I'd show all those guys in high school.
What dinosaur would you be?
I'm just kidding.
I would totally smash his truck because one time he drove by me in his truck and he yelled at me in front of his friends.
I'd show him. I think it's fine. I think there is like a need to have like a general awareness, you know, what these things do and why would you use them and why when people are talking about them, what are they talking about it doing? I feel like that's very helpful. Just because Zeldman tweets about it doesn't mean you have to use it, but it is something like, you know, if these people you kind of follow and admire, the Paul Irishes, the, you know, Adi Asmanis, the Zeldmans, if they tweet about something, then it's something maybe you should like think about just at least register in your brain that that's a tool people are using and it looks like it's getting some traction. So I should maybe think about it. You know, Polymer is one of those things I haven't used. I know what it does. I know why and I know how, but I haven't successfully used it on a project yet. So there you go. It's just this list of shame that you have to keep going. And if we're all honest about our list of shame.
I'm trying to get rid of the shame hashtag.
Oh, sorry. List of
things that you should be aware of.
Whatchamacallits.
No, it's shame. Let's be realistic. Okay. Any final thoughts on that, Sam?
So I'm tool shaming. Is that what I'm doing? I'm tool shaming. Sorry.
You are a tool.
And this is where I get a little grumpy about things, like a very like not a get off my lawn sort of thing, but we have this tendency to, oh my God, this new thing came out, it's amazing. And then when you have stuff like Twitter and everybody's talking about this one thing because one or five people mentioned it, there's this added pressure that doesn't need to be there. And that's something that used to be really overwhelming for me too. And it just got to the point, even with like grunt and gulp and all of those things, I would make the joke of like, I don't know what grunt is, so I'm going to just grunt about it, or like something really silly like that. And now I just bookmark it and I tag it with like, hey, learn this sometime where you're, when you're bored or free. And then it takes the pressure off. It's like, okay, I have it if I need it. I don't need it right now. And then I can move on and do what I need to do at that current moment. And I don't know, there's just this weird elastic, like, oh my God, we have to, like, this trend is going to be amazing, and then everybody gets sick of it. And it shouldn't be like that with just helpful tools, and we don't have to use 50 paintbrushes at the same time just because we have them.
I love it. Let me do a sponsor. We have Campaign Monitor sponsoring our podcast. This, thanks so much for your support, Campaign Monitor. It's literally campaignmonitor.com. And I just saw this. They didn't even tell me about it or anything. I'm just seeing it for the first time for everybody. It's campaignmonitor.com/canvas. And there's like a 1 minute video that you should probably watch. It's what they call their like internal tool for building an email, like the little internal app for what is it like to actually do that? Like, how do you type the titles? Where, how do you drag stuff around to make sure it looks how you want it to look? How do you, you know, drag photos and images and stuff on there? And it looks super well done. It looks like kind of the future to me in how working with websites can be. I recently just wrote a post about this, about how, like, you know, like really simple business websites, you know, I like really recommend that people just use website building tools because they're so good these days. And I know that's a big topic. Let's not dig into it right now, but it feels like that. It feels like anybody could do this. This is getting a lot easier. And if you do use it, then you're like getting all this stuff for free, like the responsiveness of it and the fact that it's going to be deliverable and it's going to, I don't know, look good and be safe and not be spammy and all that stuff that you get from using an email sending service like Campaign Monitor. And you get to use this excellent tool to do it. Gosh, I feel like I'm rambling, but check out the video for Canvas. It's really quite amazing. We use Campaign Monitor on Shop Talk Show to do our, like, if you sign up to get an email when we have a new show, that's just the RSS feed that's generated from the Shop Talk Show WordPress install. And Campaign Monitor is like looking at our RSS feed. And when there's a new entry, it sucks down that content, puts it in the template that we've created in Campaign Monitor and sends it out to all you lovely folks. And that took me about 10 minutes to set up. You know, it's like tremendously easy kind of thing to do. I love them. They're a good app. Check out campaignmonitor.com. Let's do another question. What do you got, Dave?
All right. We got another question from Ernesto Chavez. Writes in with the setup. A website has been created which contains a small app within it, server-side code. Case, client decides after some time he wants to hire his own programmer to give a constant, to give constant support to the site and app. Question, how does that work with the code you wrote? Is it property of the client? You just gave it to him, or does it have to go through negotiation in order to give him the source code?
Oh, well, there's a website. You didn't create the entire website. This is like a law question, essentially, right? Or like a ethics or business or something. You've created some component, like a little app that goes into their other website. And then they're like, we love this thing. Good work. They paid you for it. Everything is kind of completed and done. You're kind of assuming that, you know, I don't know, that you'll get like maintenance requests for this and something. But they're like, you know, we love this so much, we're going to hire somebody else to be like full time on this little app. And then you're like, yeah, but I made that thing. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So like, do they technically own it or what? And you would think that, I don't know what to tell you. I guess it should have been covered in some kind of agreement before you got to this point. Right? I mean, that would be the
right. I'm not a lawyer, so talk to your lawyer, but you would have to kind of establish where the intellectual property is divided when you, like, before you sign the contract together. So it may be too late for you right now, but it sounds to me like if he paid you to make something for him, it's his thing, you know. But if it's hosted on your servers that you maintain, then maybe it is your thing, you know. But if he paid you for that and you put it on your thing, then it's kind of like you made him something, but you keep it at your house. Kind of, does that make sense? Like he commissioned a piece of art and you hung it on your wall. So that's a little weird. It's totally right for him to be like, I want that piece of art back and I'm going to pay some dude to paint on that piece of art. I don't know.
What are your first thoughts, Sam?
I'm kind of in the same boat. Like hopefully you've worked that into your initial agreement of whenever you first started the project, and that's kind of where it lies. If it's not in there, then it's kind of hard to defend that.
Yeah, I would err on it being theirs. I mean, assuming that all went well here and they paid you for the work, I feel like you're not going to come across looking good here if you're like, no, mine, you know, like, why don't you, you know what I mean? Like you should.
Mental note, make a sound clip. Go ahead.
You could just be like, hey, maybe I want to work full time on that. But it sounds like the client is happy with your work. So you might just want to let good feelings be good feelings there. It seems like trying to fight this one would be weird, you know? And if you want the work, maybe you could, you know, make a compelling case that you should be the person who gets the more work on that job because you created it to begin with. You'd think that you'd be the most qualified anyway. And if you don't want that work, then what's the big deal?
I think that was perfectly well put. Yeah.
Next.
Next question.
If somebody tells me I did a good job answering a question.
Yeah. Here we go. Lars Bricks writes in, hey, what do you think of CSS Calc parentheses? I'm intrigued to use it in my private projects, modern browsers, but I'm not sure about the performance. It's not a big deal. I'd love to know if it's a good thing to use or if I should avoid it. You guys calcing?
I've just started using it whenever I feel like it now. I am on the Calc bandwagon.
Yeah, I bookmarked something that Eric Meyer wrote about, I think last summer, about how he was experimenting with Calc, and everything looked great because I love math stuff, but I haven't done anything with it since. Hmm.
You'll know. I think there'll be like an opportunity where it's like, this is really like the only way to do this, so we're going to do it that way. And now I think it's like surprisingly well supported, like IE9 up, right? So that's pretty good these days on a really modern project. I don't want to get into a big debate about browsers, but I'm sure y'all can imagine there are occasionally websites that we all work on that are IE9 and up, you know, that is three versions back now. So that's kind of.
What about Opera Mini, snort chuckle?
Yeah. Okay.
I'm just kidding.
Actually, Dave, it's not supported on Opera Mini 5 through 7, according to Can I Use.
Is it supported on Opera Mini anything? No, sure it's not. Yeah.
Nothing is supported on Opera Mini.
It's supported on everything that's the current version except for Opera Mini. And then for BlackBerry, you just need the WebKit prefix.
Weath. So, yeah, and if you use something like auto prefix or whatever, it just does that for you. I think it does anyway, or just, you know, be careful with it. I used it really recently Dave's, you better get ready to do a cha-ching here, but we just released this blogging feature on CodePen, that, so you can literally write blog posts on there now. I could go off on it.
Excellent! Yeah,
it's pretty neat, right? But, there comes this moment, and I don't think we've nailed this yet. We have work to do on it, but there's the place where you actually write the markdown in there, right? Like the actual editor. That thing should be probably as big as it can be on the screen because, I don't know, you want to feel like there's space to write, you know, and you want to cram it into a tiny little text area. So I'm not sure the best way. Do you make it resizable? Do you make it a setting? Do you, whatever. And so the way I ended up on it now was to use viewport height units, and then calc to like subtract out some space from that I know is kind of a fixed area. So I was like, make it as tall as the screen, except for this much.
Like a toolbar thing.
Yeah. So it was kind of nice. It was like a good use of calc. It's often nice for like 100% minus a fixed sidebar. So if you're going to like you wanted a fluid area and a fixed sidebar, you could be like, well, the column that's fluid is 100% wide minus 300 pixels or whatever, because 300 pixels is going to be this fixed sidebar. It makes scenarios like that less tricky. Just be like, just do it as a calculation. It's mostly useful for combine, not just math, but combining math that can't possibly be done except for in the browser. You know what I mean? Like, it's not just an equation that you could just do with a calculator and then put it in your CSS anyway. It's useful for situations where you don't know. It's like X wide, you know, which is often like a percentage or viewport units or whatever. Sometimes it's nice to be like, oh, I'm going to make 5 columns or 7 columns, and the math would be weird though. So like the width of this column is 100% divided by 7. You could do that with a calculator, but it's sometimes nice to look at the equation in the math instead of the thing. But that's like not my favorite use case. My favorite use cases are the ones that, you know, you couldn't possibly calculate otherwise. And then I think he asks about performance at one point in my private. I'm not sure about the performance. I would not worry about performance. I know occasionally we have to do that, but things don't make it into CSS if CSS can't deal with them in a quick way. There's things that come up once in a while and they're like, well, that would be cool, but there's no way to make that really, really fast. So we just don't do it. Like, and extreme speed is like a prereq.
I'm sure there's some CSS perf out there where somebody did 1 million pixel boxes versus 1 million calc boxes in pixel boxes one, you know, but your use case is probably on 4 elements total in the page. It's not going to matter performance wise, in my humble opinion. So,
because we have Sam here, I'm interested in how you might approach like this something in a class. Like, if that's not, it doesn't sound like it's probably part of the curriculum yet because you haven't messed with it. But like, were you like, man, maybe that should be part of the curriculum and then add it? Or what if do you just let students just find out about like stuff like that on their own and then ask you? Does that type of thing ever happen?
Sometimes it does. In the last 2 semesters, this is you might want to get the dollar cash machine thing
all right,
back up again.
Here we go. Ready?
But with CodePen, CodePen has been a big help in the class. I always used it because I was impatient about having to save, refresh in the browser. And then since they're school computers, I can't install every single program I want because there's rules for what can be installed on the computers or not. So I just go to CodePen and type stuff out and, you know, just tweet out the pens to my students for little silly things, even just fixed width versus flexible width, that sort of stuff. And then if it was something like this, what I would probably see myself doing is, hey, by the way, this is a thing. I'm going to do a quick 5-minute demo now, and then part of your homework assignment is to just try it out and see if you have any questions and we can talk about it. And then this last semester, I didn't require this at all, but every single student signed up for CodePen and then ended up kind of just forking off of stuff and then getting a lot more comfortable with it. So we didn't spend too much time in class. They kind of used CodePen as a office hours / not in the classroom hours classroom.
Got it. Sweet.
I think, yeah, final answer, use it.
Yeah.
Is that, I think use Calc.
Of course. Right. Look at the browser support and then use it if you can.
Yeah.
An awesome fan in the chat room, he was saying, said, if you are using like a preprocessor, like if you're like doing 100% divided by 7 or something like that, that's probably a good place to let the preprocessor just figure that out. Like if you can, if it's just simple, like things, like just let the preprocessor do it. But if it's like 100% minus 30 pixels, that's where the browser comes in. So. Anyway, hope that helps. Next. Oh, do you want to do another sponsor, Chris? Does that sound good?
Yeah, we're about at that point. And this one's a fun one anyway because everybody it's the CSS Summit. So go to csssummit.com. It'll redirect you to the place you need to go. It is coming up this July 15th through 17th. That's coming up. As we speak, it's less than a month away. So when this airs, it'll be maybe 3 weeks, 2-3 weeks away. So make your decisions quick. Start pitching your bosses quickly or whatever, or just cough up and come to it because it's a summit. So it's not particularly expensive anyway as these things go because you attend it from anywhere in the world with the browser. You know, you just you log in and watch and you can see the speakers speak, you know, in a video thing. And there's a chat room for everybody and you get the slides from there and all this stuff. You can ask questions directly to the presenter through there. So there's actually more questions generally being asked than in real life, because I feel like, you know, as soon as you think of it, you can just type it in there and then they kind of save them up and ask the presenters at the end. It's really cool. And this is a big one. This is a 3-day one. This is one of their biggest ones. I'd say it's, you know, they have, you know, a lot of them are 1-day things too, which are awesome too, but this is like a seminal Environments for Humans Summit. There's super practical stuff, I feel like Estelle Wild talks about CSS selectors, you know, she kills it on those, like, this is the way it is, kids, things. So, like, if you want super practical stuff, you know, Ben Callahan talking about responsive design, he's just going to tell it like it is. Then there's, like, looks at the future, I feel like, where, like, Tab Atkins shows up and talks about, you know, he literally works on CSS. So he's like, this is what it's going to be like in the future. This is what we're thinking of. Chris Epstein talking about, this is SAS. This is what it is now. This is what the future of SAS is going to be like. And then there's stuff that I'm just, like, scratching my head about, that's the number one thing I would go to because I don't know anything about it and want to learn more, you know, like all kinds of crazy talks. There's a talk about Yeoman, random, of course, you know, because I don't know nothing about that. What's one that I, yeah, anyway, there's a bunch of stuff. And that'll be like that way for you too. They'll be like, this one looks awesome and I want to have what I know about this reaffirmed and I don't know anything about this one, so I want to make sure that I go to this. You know, Rachel Andrew talking about ebooks stuff. I don't know anything about that, but I'm sure it'll be fascinating because turns out you can lay out a book using CSS. Who knew, right?
Justine Jordan talking about responsive emails, which will blow your mind.
Yeah, that is
an amazingly wild world out there.
Sure is, you know, all the rules are off in that land. So anyway, you should go to it if you want to. Oh, and you can win a free ticket if you want to. I think you if you really want to go, you should just, you know, save up your quarters and go. But we're going to give away a ticket too. So thanks to them for giving us a ticket to give away. What we're going to do is we're going to be really super specific about how you can win this ticket. You have to follow all of these rules or you're not going to win. Just because it'll be easier for us and you and everything. When you send in a question, which you can do at shoptalkshow.com/ask, there's a WooFoo form sitting there, right? It's just, you know, whatever. That's how you ask us a question. Hashtag it in there, hashtag summit. So I know it feels weird to hashtag something that's just in a text area, but just do it because then we can search for it easier. So hashtag summit, and then send us a question that is specific here. And I don't want this to be weird, but I'm thinking about changing careers or I'm wondering about education or life advice kind of questions. We have actually kind of a lot of those. And I feel like maybe some of you are getting sick of that stuff. It's fun to talk about, but this is a front end design and development show. We need some front end design and development questions. So it's like, let's have it be techie and let's bring the nerd back on Chop Talk Show. So ask something about front end design and development. It would be awesome if it was an MP3. It doesn't have to be as long as it's about tech nerd stuff. And hashtag it summit and send it in and we'll pick one. Maybe in 2 weeks.
Next show, probably. Oh, 2 weeks?
Yeah,
okay.
Just because I think there'll still be time to get in then. You'll find out last minute, although maybe we should do it next week because we don't want people to wait till the last second to buy a ticket if they don't win. Let's do it next week.
You got Thursday 1 week. Something or other.
Yep.
Thursday the 20-somethingth of June. You got to get it in. All right.
We have Sam for a little while longer here. Let's ask some questions so we can get...
Here's another audio question, our favorite kind of question here at the Shop Talk Show.
Excellent show today. I really like the idea of embedding above the fold CSS in the head and including the rest at the bottom of the page. Do you see any drawbacks with this method?
Okay.
So this was probably from a show where we talked about
CSS. But this has been a hot topic lately is this idea of inlining CSS. And that's a weird word for it because it doesn't really mean inlining styles right on div, like on the actual elements, although I guess it could. It's talking about taking CSS that's like really important to page layout so things aren't like shifting around and being weird and putting it in a style block at the top of the page, which is a little weird, right? But the idea is, of course, all your CSS should go up there, but it's taking less of it, a smaller subsection of your CSS, putting at the top of the page so that most of the layout stuff is done, then load all your content, then load the full set of your CSS later, either async load it or load it at the bottom of the page or whatever. And it just it ends up being kind of a better loading experience, probably particularly on mobile. Is that basically what?
Yeah. Yeah. The idea is you're going to get if you have your CSS block, like inline block in the first 14 kilobytes of your response, the browser will make a paint as soon as it can. So it'll paint the page. And
it's meaning kind there's of content there. You can read stuff.
Yep, it's kind of a perceived performance thing. So like the browser will paint and then your user will be like, I can actually use this page and I didn't wait 100 hours for it. So that's kind of the thing. And with mobile, it's super sensitive, right? Because they could be on 3G crap network. So you got to be considerate of that.
There's so much to think about here. I'm kind of trying to commission an article on CSS tricks. Not that I couldn't do it myself. I probably could, but you know, there's so much stuff going on right now, and I've found somebody that like knows some stuff about it. They're going to try to write about it. There's a lot of different ways. For example, there's a SAS technique where you can be like, okay, you decide as an author what's critical and what's not, and you put stuff in a mix-in that says, okay, this part, this is critical, so that when you output your SAS, it can output that block that you need to inline at the top, which is pretty clever. Pretty but there's so many other ways to do it. You know, there's the Scott Gell load CSS thing,
load CSS. New,
which is just like a few got lines of JavaScript that kind of asynchronously pulls in CSS later. Anyway, have you heard anything about this type of stuff, Sam? Is this in your wheelhouse?
I haven't too much. That's kind of awesome and it makes sense. I'm just wondering kind of where the threshold, is it a size-wise threshold that you make this decision of doing that or... device-based?
Well, that's what the conversation is about right now. Those are all the right questions.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. So there's kind of this size thing, right? Like the average packet size from your Apache server is like 14 kilobytes gzipped. So that could be however much ungzipped. So, but the theory is if you put your CSS in the head in, you know, minified and everything, it should make it in that packet. You know, the TCP IP packet. And that's like heavy duty networking stuff. Even I don't understand. So that's the idea. And I think it's just, you basically just include the minimum viable CSS that it takes to render the fold or the top of the page kind of. That's how it's pitched, but I don't really believe in the fold. That's one drawback I would maybe have, right? Is like, fold. Interesting you say that. What is it, you know?
Yeah, with responsive, I don't know if there is a fold. I don't believe in the fold.
Well, there's other ways either to think about it. Maybe we could do we let a tool totally figure this out for it all by itself? That's one way to do it. Just like, let some smart people deal with this. I'll run it through as a build step and I won't ever have to think about it. It's just going to do the right thing for me. Then there's the really manual way to do it, which is that I'm going to decide as an author what is critical and what is not, and that's what I'll load in the head. And then maybe there's a middle ground, right, where it could be like, okay, anything that looks layout related in the CSS, I'm going to determine that as critical, and anything that's not, I'm going to do otherwise. So it would still be a build step thing, but it would be a little bit more specific. Those are three totally different approaches that I came up with in the last 10 seconds. But that's what these conversations need to be about, I think, because I think this is going to be like a thing, right?
I think it's a thing, yeah. Well, in that Addy article he cited, Addy Asmani article, is, you know, he's like, there's a mod page speed plugin, which is an Apache plugin that does this for you, and it gives you like a speed boost. So it's kind of a recommendation. They're saying like, this needs it, so... You should.
I wonder if the world will stop caring about. That'll be the new hipster thing, is to be like, you know, flash of unstyled. That's like a badge of honor, because now we're just going to start loading CSS at the bottom because it's not important. Only content is. So, you know,
that's maybe the debate, right? Is content more important than content fouting or whatever, fouking?
Well, because imagine what would happen is if everybody did this, right? You'd almost for surely see a bunch of just on totally unstyled page in a first paint, and then the CSS would come down and everything would swap, and it would be awkward and weird, and we don't do that these days. It's like not in vogue. That would be considered gross, probably, but it might not. Maybe if we just start, you know, if we start assuming that's how websites load.
I mean, I remember a lot of people freaking out when people started putting their Typekit stuff at the end so that it would flicker the type after the content loaded. People freaked out. They're like, oh, what the hell is this? I can't believe it. And maybe it's something worth trying, but at the same time, I don't know how I feel about layout loading after content.
It's weird.
I mean, I think your layout needs to be set up in a way that, or sorry, your content needs to be laid out in a way that it works in a reader and all that sort of stuff. So if you're good there, you should be fine.
Yeah, there are UX concerns is what you're saying, yeah. I think, right? Like, yeah. That's just weird if all of a sudden something flies away, you know?
It drastically changes, yeah. Like there's no slab serif system
font. Such a big deal. In fact, I was just talking with Vitaly from Smashing Mag, and they have they're okay with Fount on their site now. Essentially, they load it in some cool way. Like they detect if they have the font cached, and if they do, they load it kind of the normal way. If they don't, I think they Ajax it in somehow and then chuck it in local storage and then flop it out. And so if this is the first time loading the site, you'll get it. You'll get the flash of unstyled, which only happens once, and then you reload it again, and it's probably in local storage if it fits okay, and then it grabs it right away. So having a one time fout penalty, or what are we, is that what we're calling it still, fout?
Yeah, fout. Well,
which,
yeah.
I think is reasonable.
Usually it's text. Text is kind of the big one, right?
Yeah, which that's not important. Content, that's not a user experience concern, flipping out text. People might be like, hey, that was weird, but they're not going to be like, oh my God, I lost my place in checkout. You know, it's not like that big of a deal.
You know, maybe it's because I haven't thought about this for more than 10 minutes because I didn't even know that was a thing. But I'm wondering if going back to having it, including the layout load later, what that would do to somebody with a really slow internet connection. How long that would take. And
yeah, I mean, there's a chance your JavaScript or server craps out, right?
Yeah.
And so then it never loads, right?
Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry, I interrupted.
Well, yeah, I think the idea is still forming in my head as I'm speaking out loud, and that probably wasn't a good idea.
Oh, it is a good idea.
I'm just kind of wondering, I feel like the idea of, oh yeah, just have it load at the end seems like it might be helpful to different scenarios, but at the same time, I'm not sure if it, I feel like it, the idea is sort of, at least just from what I've heard about it, is assuming that this will be like a really quick load and the end user won't really see the difference other than a quick flicker.
Yeah, we all know that ain't true.
Yeah.
Okay. Should we try to fit in one more? Are we done?
Hey. Let's do, Sam, you got time or you?
Yeah,
you
I got
a
time.
Class. Okay. Yeah, all right.
What if a school bell rings in the background?
There awesome. Are no school bells.
Ding, ding, ding. You're like, gotta go. all right. Oh boy. Here we go. Ricardo Munoz Crespo writes in, I am almost 18 years old, work part-time as a freelance full-stack web developer and web designer while also working as a lead developer of a startup. I am a high school dropout and also do not attend college. I do have some spare time available during the evening and on weekends. I personally want to invest some of that spare time into open source projects. However, I keep getting anxiety whenever I start. I always think about the actual time I need to invest in such a project. And if I start my own, I would also need to maintain it! !! Emphasis added. I myself don't really gain anything, hence I'd rather invest time into my education, increasing my skill set, or build up another business. So how can I finally get started with contributing to open source projects? Am I just being egotistic or lazy? Sam?
There's a lot of stuff in that question.
It is. Ricardo, you're 17. And not being ageist here, but you're 17 and you're the lead developer for a startup. And now you're like, I need to spend more time in front of a computer. That seems weird to me already. I would be like, and you're thinking about this open source world and you're like, I would like to contribute more to it. But it sounds like you've already weighed the pluses and minuses. You've already figured out that this is a commitment. And there's some maintenance things and some expectations involved when I do that. And that seems like it's too much for me. So I'm starting to think about doing these other things to better myself instead. It sounds like you've already came to your conclusion. Like, don't do it if you'd rather do some other things, you know? So I'm curious what the thinking is there. If you really feel like you're missing out by not getting in on some open source stuff or what? So that's the stage, I think.
I would kind of recommend to refactor the thinking a little bit and say, sure, it's great to contribute to the open source world, but if you are really interested in the education side and you do have the time, then just start a project for yourself that allows you to learn something new. And then at the end of the project, you can gauge and see, hey, this is something that would benefit other people. Then put it out there. Having that pressure of, I have to contribute to this thing makes it really hard. And that's probably where the anxiety is coming from, because you're already freaking yourself out when you could just have fun and learn something new. And then based on what happens, you either don't share it and there's nothing lost because you still learned something from it, or if it's something that other people can learn from, then yeah, just share it.
Nice. What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I think if you're not like, if it doesn't seem like open source fits into your life or whatever, don't do it. like it sounds like you have enough on your plate. Don't do it. But I feel like where, and maybe this has already been touched on, but just where it comes into value is like, let's say your business, your new startup has a tool that you depend on and you'd like it to share it and you'd like to, you know, like, and you'd like to make it better with the hive mind of a million people on GitHub, then that's something where you'd want to open source it. But if you're like, nope, this is proprietary, this is mine, I use this only, this is how I'm going to get rich, then yeah, don't share it. That's fine. But if it's some dumb jQuery plugin, and I speak from experience, open source it. But expect to spend, you know, 4, 6, or 8 hours a week working on this stuff, even super passively. I mean, if you run some, you know, high end node module, you're probably, that's probably a full time job, or at least 20, 30 hours a week. So
could be, yeah, I would say, you know, and I hate to, nobody wants to hear this stuff, but I'm just going to be like a dad, even though I'm not a dad, but like, man, it seems 17 seems like a little young to me to be like, I need to spend every single, I'm going to drop out of high school and spend every single second of my time doing web stuff. Like, just seems burnouty to me. It might seem like you're killing it right now, and you probably are, but like, man, yeah, take it easy. Oh, just.
Yep. Anyway. Download World of Warcraft or Diablo and yeah. Just
buy a skateboard.
Enjoy. Yeah. Go outside. That's good.
Go outside, kid.
You're better dad than me. Hashtag dad life, the Chris Boyer story. All right. We should wrap it up. Sam Cap it is. Thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Two things for those who aren't following you or whatever. How can people follow you, get in touch with you, give you money? And then what's the one big thing you'd like to plug? What's your big pitch?
Oh my goodness. I mean, the best place to get a hold of me is Twitter. So it's just Sam Cap. That's Cap with a K. That's the best place. Everything about me is on there, linked on there, all of that good stuff. I actually have nothing to plug at the moment, which is kind of weird.
That'd be good.
Go Shop Talk Show.
Not a plug. Hey. Sweet. Yeah. Awesome. Well, and thanks again. Thanks everyone for listening in the chat room. If I have a plug, and Chris, we should maybe do a book segment on a future show. But Scott McCloud's book, Understanding Comics. I've been reading through that. I know you read through it,
yeah,
Chris.
Yeah, isn't it good?
Super. Oh, my. It's changing my view of life. It's wonderful. Yeah. I really enjoy it.
It's very
it.
Good so, at explaining things, and it's meta, too, in that it explains it through comics. So, and it, like, nice. Works even if you, like, are adverse to comics. I wouldn't say adverse, but I never went through a comics thing when I was a kid, but it doesn't matter. Like, by page two, you're like, oh, I get it. This is super-duper readable. Anyway.
It's pretty cool. Anyway, so
my book one would be Nicely Said, a new book by Nicole Slaw or whatever on Twitter and Kate Kiefer from MailChimp. Anyway.
Yeah, that book looks so good so far. Yeah,
I'm like
can't wait to get
third
into it.
Through it maybe. It's really good. But it's just a book that needed to be written, I think. It's kind of like how to write for the web because everybody does it. And so we need a book to talk about it, I think. And it's there now. Mm-hmm. I bought a whole bunch of books. I posted it on Instagram because I'm like, you know what? It's time for me to level up in some like in things that are related to the web but aren't Anyway, you finish it up, Dave. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to hide.
Oh, anyways, thanks everyone for listening. Be sure to follow us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter and tell us the books you're reading. Ha ha, Summer Book Club. Here we go. And thanks everyone. You're the best. Chris, you got anything there?
ShopTalkShow.com.